Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's program focuses on the advancement of technology and business throughout Africa as a result of the opening and connecting of their economies and the privatization of state-run industries. 27 out of 30 of Africa's largest economies have experienced enviable economic growth. It has allowed new enterprises to emerge and entrepreneurs to flourish. While no two countries on the continent are alike, some have caught the attention of Silicon Valley venture capital firms and leading U.S. companies. To learn about the role Silicon Valley may play in Africa, we'll hear from Jake Bright, Whitehead Fellow with the Foreign Policy Association, Chris Forlion, founder and CEO of Mall for Africa, and Aubrey Ruby, visiting fellow with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. This program was recorded before a live World Affairs Council audience in San Francisco. And now to our moderator, Quentin Hardy, Deputy Technology Editor for The New York Times.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. Our topic tonight is the potential for a dramatic and positive transformation in a place that for far too long seems to have borne far too many of the world's woes. Home to over 1 billion consumers, many vibrant cultures, a young and entrepreneurial population, and rich natural resources, most Americans nonetheless see Africa as a hapless place of wars, disease, and corruption. We hope to change that view somewhat tonight. Admittedly, they do see this not without cause. But our guests tonight, however, ask you to look deeper. They see fundamental changes in technology, communications, and perhaps even governance, which may well, in this generation, turn Africa into one of the world's fastest growing and most hopeful places. Now, I have some bios and you've seen them, but I'd rather begin with a question across the audience where you introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about your own experience. What are the biggest changes that make you hopeful about Africa? What have you personally seen and done that convinces you change is afoot? Chris, why don't you begin?
Sure. My name is Chris Fulay. I'm the founder and CEO for Mall for Africa. And to answer your question, I think the major change I've seen in Africa is with the technology and even just the people themselves having this new look on Africa and what Africa can do. Technology has definitely progressed significantly over the past few years. You have significant bandwidth throughout the continent. You have a lot of people who are trying to do things better and trying to improve their lives and the lives of the people in the continent. So you need to take that into account when you have a technology shift and you have a mental shift within the people of the continent saying, you know we can do better. We know there are better things we can do to improve our lives and the lives of the future generations.
When you speak of bandwidth, you mean internet connectivity.
I'm talking
particularly
about
high-speed internet connectivity, which I take it allows people to do what? To communicate, to see more of the world, to organize, what sort of things?
To do all those things and more. One thing about Africans that many people would know about is we are very ingenious people. So we'll use whatever we can get and squeeze out every cent of anything we can get from it. So when you talk about technology, or when I talk about bandwidth, I'm talking about using the internet and, you know, the fact that you're now connected online to use that for everything and anything possible, be it purchasing merchandise, which is what Mall for Africa allows people to do, or even just communication and providing pictures about, you know, things that are happening or talking about things, you know, everything from social media. You have Nigeria being one of the top leading countries in the world that's on Facebook and, you know, utilizing resources to the best of their capabilities. So that's something you definitely see out of Africa.
Aubrey?
So for the last 12 years or so, I've been advising companies on investing in the region, and I've had the honor of working for many blue chip American companies, Fortune 50 companies doing business across the region, but also working on behalf of African governments to attract investment in key sectors and then funds looking to invest in the countries. And one of the changes I've seen over the last decade or so is that, and this is kind of coming into the title of the book, the next Africa. That in the old Africa, the only kind of way to kind of prominence and social power and influence in countries was through government or ties to government in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, traditionally the private sectors were very small and dependent on the public sectors across the region, especially in the smaller countries. Nigeria has always had a pretty robust private sector. But what I've seen in the shift in the last decade is that this rise of the kind of business class that have made their wealth, and they have accumulated their experience in the private sector independent of the public sector. And it's created an alternative kind of route for prestige that really inspires others. It changes the political economy of the country. It creates a whole business constituency for change. And it really is driving in some of the reforms that you see in doing business across the region. And I think that trend is a positive one into the future. So the more we can see young children reading books about, you know, Aliko Dangote rather than the freedom fighter generation, it creates a different path for future growth.
We should say, I was speaking with Aubrey Ruby in before the meeting, and you said people are always surprised that you came to Africa without having been an aid worker or a child of a missionary, that there are these presuppositions. You come to Africa as some person bringing charity, and that really isn't your experience at all.
No, I've actually never worked a straight business deal for you. Yeah, I've never worked for NGOs or for the aid establishment, and it's an assumption that's made even in Washington regularly. And many of them do very good work, but it's just not where the approach I've taken. I've really believed in job creation coming in mass from the private sector, and that's really the only way to create the millions of jobs that are needed to match the desires and the aspirations of Africa's young people with their means. So, you know, what we have is the technology that Chris was speaking about has created an exponential increase in everyone's aspirations. But the Malthusian problem is that their means are only increasing arithmetically until we have some kind of takeoff on major job creation. So I've always taken it from a private sector perspective.
And Jake, what is the thing you've seen as you travel in Africa and work with Africans that convinces you a really deep and meaningful change is afoot?
Well, I'll go back to my first experience in Africa. And by background, I'm from the Midwest. I come from a family that had and has no background in Africa. Aubrey and I are very similar in that way. And my first experience in Africa goes back to when I was 19 years old. And I went kind of by accident on a year abroad trip and ended up in Sierra Leone working with the local Sierra Leonean Red Cross Society. And, you know, that was during the 90s when Africa was a pretty tricky place to travel in some places. And some of my impressions on that first trip, they obviously changed my course of study. They changed my career because I've continued to do stuff with Africa throughout my career academically and then business media and then finally this book. But one of the things that I came away with, even at a time of war in Sierra Leone, was I saw tremendous potential. And I never really saw, I saw a lot of very challenging things in West Africa, but I never came away with this thesis that I needed to help Africans. I came away with this thesis that this place has just tremendous potential, but what it's lacking are certain favorable structural circumstances. When Aubrey and I talk about our foundations with Africa, I think both of us, in our experience that evolved from the first time we ever went to the continent, kind of continue to develop that thesis that absolutely tremendous potential, especially on the human side, but you know, very challenging structural circumstances. So to move forward to why you know we've kind of changed our view now and have a fairly upbeat assessment of Africa, it's some of these structural circumstances. So two things: the structural circumstances are changing, and we go into detail on that in the book. But basically, you have better governance, you have better infrastructure coming. You have broadband coming, you have investment flowing into Africa in record amounts, you have new partnerships. So you have better structural circumstances. But the most important thing that I see, and I think from our research with the book, that I see connecting with that is this tremendously talented cadre of Africans that have emerged over the last 20 years. It's not that there weren't talented Africans before, but through this book, we've had this opportunity to meet with entrepreneurs like Chris, to talk to Africans in the diaspora. And when you connect this highly talented group of Africans that are emerging in just about any sector you can imagine, we talk to people in music, in fashion, in technology, in government. When you connect that and these people really driving forward on this continent and in the diaspora with these improving structural circumstances, I mean, that really whittles down our thesis with this book about why many things in Africa are going to change to where the narrative changes and people interact very differently with the continent over the next 20 years than they did over the last 20 years.
One of the themes that you cite in the book and in a way that you are leveraging in your work is a kind of dawning normality, if you will, about Africa, that there are, yes, Africans who win Oscars, Africans who are shortlisted for the Booker Prize, Africans who are successful businessmen, and in your case, Chris, Africans who, by getting on the internet through sites like yours or means they discover, are turning into normal consumers of goods. And it's this kind of blessings of normality advent that takes Africa out of a context of, well, it's Nelson Mandela or it's Ebola. That's your choice of headline. Yeah. And it kind of normalizes things. What do you think is making it a more normal place, if you will?
From my perspective, I think it's the proliferation of other voices in the space. So it becomes muddy. The picture is not as clear. In the book we talk about what we call the pundit's pendulum on Africa, that essentially over the last 20 years or longer, it's either this swing between stories of insane optimism, the Africa rising and you know, this all better, the miracle has finally come to the continent, you know, left Asia, now it's in Africa, that kind of thing, or it's like apocalyptic. And it's just back and forth, but it's hard to have like a normal view that like some things are good, some things are bad. That's not very, it doesn't fetishize Africa in the way we've been used to,
right,
in putting it in a very simple box. And one of our assertions in the book is that it'll get harder year on year on year to put Africa in a simple box. And then the countries, you know, it's so many different countries. Nigeria has got some incredible things going for it that are very different than Kenya, but they're both, you know, moving forward at a rapid rate. And, you know, that difference will be coming out too. And so as all these, the technology empowers new voices, new people at the table, you have, you know, Lupita in film, and you have Duru Lu in fashion, you have all these people speaking, that it doesn't lend itself to one clear narrative anymore.
And that's healthy.
And that's healthy.
I see. And Chris, your commerce site, it's largely out of Nigeria, right?
Yeah, we are currently mostly focused in Nigeria, but we're also serving Ghana, Kenya, and we're going to be doing the DRC and Tanzania later on this year. But yeah, it's mostly focused on Nigeria. And to answer your question about the normalcy, what we've seen is, you know, the gone, we feel, and I think that's part of the book, gone are the days of the old Africa, which is where we're moving into this new Africa. And it's really about the driving force of the people within the continent and the people themselves. They've, you know, we've gone out of that, I guess, stigmatic notion where, you know, we're backwards. And, you know, I've spoken about when people think about Africa, many people think about a kid with what's called kwashoko, which is, you know, a kid on the floor with a big belly and flies on their lips and a bowl of water beside them. You know, that's not the Africa that exists today. And I think many people have that old picture within their brains instilled from, you know, old textbooks or old pictures. The Africa today is an Africa that, you know, has skyscrapers, has nice cars, and people who want to do great things, and people who want to buy products from the U.S. and from Europe, and want to just, you know, live what we would call a normal life here. And they expect the quality of the products that are coming out of here. They expect to be able to, you know, do online transactions and literally live somewhat of what we would call a normal life. here. And that's what Nigerians are definitely striving for, and I know other parts of Africa are striving for also. And they're leveraging, to go back to technology, they're leveraging technology seriously in order to gain all of those.
You know, Jake, we talk about Africa catching up, but in some ways, it's leapfrogging too. If you look at things like the use of mobile banking and the transition of money into a kind of electronic good that is shifting around through Safaricom in Kenya and things like that. Do you think those are deep forces that'll shape not just a small part of the continent, but many countries?
Absolutely. And one thing, we talked about it earlier with the student class, one thing that Aubrey and I also set forward in the book is we're not saying that the nation state has become obsolete, but we also look very much at nation state. But we also looked at kind of a worldview that dealt with patterns of things. Patterns among people, patterns among data, patterns among commerce, right? So a lot of things we're talking about in more of our really long view about becoming a global powerhouse, you know, some of the things, African countries becoming global powerhouses, that might take longer. But when you get into patterns of related to institutions and people, that's where we're longer on the view of becoming a global powerhouse. Going back to leapfrogging, we actually, I think, both share a view that when you look at some of the trends in Africa, there's greater potential for leapfrogging. And essentially, leapfrogging is like, here's an example. With mobile money, you know, Africa has probably the most recognized case of technological leapfrogging in the world. And the basic concept is you had a country like Kenya, which had little to no branch banking infrastructure, had people that needed to do financial transactions, didn't have a strong banking infrastructure, but have mobile phones and some kind of digital infrastructure. So you have this M-Pesa mobile money app, which essentially is like putting a branch bank service right on somebody's phone. And what you've done is you've had Kenyans with this viable service. They've leapfrogged branch banking. They've gone right over it and moved into the digital finance world, right? What you have happening in Africa is one other thing that we focused on is in addition to all this technology and investment, this is all going into a continent that, from an economic standpoint, is largely informal. So 50% of Africa's GDP growth is off the grid, right? So it's not taxed. And it's not to say that there wasn't commerce. There's tremendous amount of commerce. There's a huge trading history in Africa. There's all this commerce going on. But now suddenly you have this formalization of these economies, all this investment going in, tremendous entrepreneurs like Chris and others going back to find commercial solutions to commercial problems. And just to conclude, one of the things you notice in Africa is that a lot of our innovation in the U.S., and some of the entrepreneurs we talked to like Chris and others pointed this out, that a lot of innovation that we've had in the U.S. is replacing long existing patterns, right? So for example, e-commerce is replacing a long existing pattern of people going to the store or even people ordering stuff out of catalogs. What you have in Africa is you have some of these very advanced commercial things related to technology or e-commerce or mobile finance. They're not replacing patterns. They're being established immediately with a young generation as the standard. It's all, there's some Africans who, they're not gonna make their first e-commerce purchase and cell phone purchase. It's going to be at the same time. They're going to make their first e-commerce and smartphone purchase at the same time. They won't have known anything else. So you have this potential for these patterns to be established right from the start, which leapfrog a lot of things. Like even in video on demand, some people will never go buy a CD in Africa. They may never go, you know, do certain things. So anyways, you have this potential for these patterns to be established right from the start. Mm-hmm. And that's where the potential for leapfrogging comes in.
Right. Now, I think people are already in their heads forming a sort of yes, but, you know, and yes, there's this fantastic technology and there's better governance, but there is the ongoing tragedies of South Sudan. There is massive out-migration of people from Central Africa traveling all the way to Tunisia in order to get to Italy. There is Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. There are on a more prosaic level, there are regular power outages across Nigeria. Mm-hmm. Do those things impede or stop the trends you're seeing? Or do you think these are coexisting, or even do the bad things become smothered by the good?
I think that there are bumps in the road, and there are constraints on growth, but they're not derailing growth. And so in the book, we do have a chapter called Deal Breakers. You know, it's talking about the African growth story. What are the things that actually could significantly derail the growth story? Not just bumps in the road or not constraints on growth, because there are a lot of constraints on growth. Power issue in Nigeria, if electricity was readily available at cheaper prices across Nigeria, estimates are that GDP growth rates as a whole in the country would increase by 2 to 4%. Just humongous. I mean, it would be like the U.S. doubling the growth rate for, you know, on an annual basis because power is right. So that is constraining growth, but it's not derailing growth in Nigeria. And so we see the things that can derail growth or significantly alter the past, things like a failure to create jobs. Because you have 70% of people under the age of 30. You have the fastest growing youth population in the world. Nigeria still have 5.2 children per woman right now. You need to create jobs at an exponential rate in order to absorb, like that, to square that Malthusian issue that I just spoke about, that the aspirations of the youth is outstripping their means with no jobs. So a failure to create jobs, a failure to have responsive institutions that kind of meet those needs. And they don't have to be perfect institutions. They just have to be working more in the public good than against it. And then lastly, black swan type events, you know, if an Ebola had been very, very contagious and spread over the whole region, then maybe it would have derailed growth for a decade, something of that sort. So, those were the main ones. The other things that you mentioned are, in my view, constraints to growth and or countries that are going to specifically struggle. It's not that all countries are going to rise equally. Some countries are going to suffer because of institutional problems, because of geography problems, because of all kinds of things more than others.
What you're saying is it's going to be discontinuous on a micro level within countries where some will get rich and others will struggle, and it's going to be discontinuous on a continent-wide basis where countries will
navigate that every day. I mean, you look at people who've made fortunes in Silicon Valley companies, and then you walk around the streets of San Francisco right outside and see like a significantly challenging homeless population that, so we deal with that. That inconsistency all the time. So yes, there are going to be billionaires coming out of Nigeria and Kenya, but there are also people who haven't found their way in the economy and are going to do everything they can to get to Europe. Mm-hmm. And those things exist side by side.
I'd like to add to that. So I was born and raised in Nigeria. So when you come out of such an environment, or you live in such an environment, you do have something I believe everyone or many Africans are instilled with, which is a concept of where there's a will, there's a way. So even though Boko Haram might be attacking in one place, we still, and I don't want to say that we take that as normal, because that's not the case. It's not. People are dying, and we definitely feel that. But you do grow up saying to yourself, I'm going to succeed. I'm going to achieve something. So whether there's a war going on here or there's a fight going on there, you still have it in you to push and persevere. And to piggyback on what Aubrey said, I mean, I don't think it's derailing it. It might be slowing things down. But, you know, even without power, people have come up with ingenious ideas on, you know, alternative power sources. You hear about all of these amazing ideas coming out of Africa on, you know, alternative means of doing X or alternative means of doing Y. And it's literally because, you know, there's that driving force and push to get things done and to get something done. And I think
one thing you're talking about there is that there is now a better velocity of communications.
Yeah.
So people can organize and share ideas better than they used to. And that's the mobile phone.
Yes, that and it's just, it's literally the push and drive. I mean, technology and the mobile phones and everything that has come with that has been awesome and great. But you still now you still have a group of people, the younger generation like me, coming up saying, we're going to succeed, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And whatever roadblocks may come, you know, you still figure it out. And that has happened for me and even with my business. I mean, the customs shut down entirely during Christmas of last year. I mean, literally, customs just said, boom, we're done, we're closed. You know, and I was like, okay, you know, this is Christmas.
That was a bad day.
Yeah, it's a bad 2 months. But, but you know, it's so you see that, and some people would say, okay, well, you know, give up. What can you do? Customs is shut down. You know, but you figure out, okay, well, what are my other options? So customs here might have shut down. Are there, is there any other way I can do business? And you know, you just try and you figure things out. And I think a lot of Africans are doing that right now. They're figuring stuff out and they're making things happen.
And we have a couple of questions from the audience, two of which do figure into the yes but category. One having to do with whether you're overstating the changes, that broadband is nice, but isn't it in under 20% of the countries? And there are successful economies, but aren't they fundamentally fragile economies? And what do you say to that?
I mean, I think that one of the things we did with the book was we really tried to establish a view that went long on Africa, but we also tried to establish a view, a way of looking at Africa that deals with parallel realities and parallel complexity, the same way we do with the rest of the world. And there seems to be this pressure on Africa that it has to be like this straight up or down proposition. And there are these standards that are being put on Africa that we don't think are being applied to other places in the world, right? So look at the history of the United States of America. I mean, we had periods of lawlessness. We had periods of environmental, you know, decay. We had periods where we need to establish antitrust laws. You know, it took a long time to get all these things to come together. And I think what you're getting is you're dealing with human beings, right? And we do some stuff right, and we screw stuff up, and that's just how we do stuff. I think what you're trying to get in these broader environments is you're trying to get patterns of things where you finally get some progress. And fundamentally what we're saying is that, yeah, of course there's going to be mass challenges in Africa, and there's still going to be headlines about war and disease, but that's just the world. But what we think is that there are enough aggregating trends across people, across technology, across investment, across partnerships, across connectivity to the global economy, that finally you're going to get in Africa where certain parts, certain organizations, and certain groups of people finally start to have progress where they start to overshadow some of the continent's challenges. Not that the challenges are going to go away, not that they're going to vanish, but you're finally going to have an Africa where progress starts to overshadow its challenges. And in the past, that really hasn't been the narrative at all, partly because there have been a lot of negative things in Africa, but partly because there has been a skewed way, let's face it, there has been a skewed way to cover Africa for the last 20 to 30 years.
Yeah. So, but I think that on the broadband, yes, it does only cover 20% in some countries, just the same way that electricity varies. So, for example, Ghana covers 80% of its population with electricity. Uganda is less than 10%. Demand's growing at 15% a year. Then you have situations like power in Nigeria can run anywhere from, I don't know, 27 cents a kilowatt hour up to, depending on the price of diesel, into the 40s and 50s per kilowatt hour, which is, you know, eight times what Americans pay. In Ethiopia, power is 4 cents a kilowatt hour and the cheapest in the world. So you have this variation by country that changes these kind of realities. And you do have a lot of countries that their economic growth and their economies are much less fragile than they used to be. And what do I mean by that? I mean a reduced dependence on commodities. So a lot of the countries, including Nigeria, have found that their GDP growth is coming from other areas, not just oil and extractives. And you have that ability to reduce the commodity dependence limits some of the fluctuations that the economy saw before. additional growth from one neighbor spills over to the other. And as integration and trade deepens, that those ties grow. So, you know, research out of Oxford has shown that if your neighbor grows by 1%, you grow by 0.3 to 0.4%. So that's a serious, significant positive spillover. So the more you trade and the deeper those relationships are building, and right now inter-African trades increased by 22% year on year, those kind of positive spillovers.
The inter-African trade is particularly interesting.
And Quentin, could I just add one more thing, and it'll turn into a question for Chris. A lot of the skepticism, we actually have been able to turn it into an upside. And this comes from the Africa Leaders Summit, where some of the presidents and some of the leaders there said, if we've had all this progress without electricity, right, with all these structural challenges, imagine how much further Africa's entrepreneurs and economies could surge. So Chris, for example, for your business, and you forged into this business that requires these very particular things. I mean, if Nigeria improved its roads or had basic, you know, even incremental improvements in roads, electricity, and bandwidth, I mean, what would that mean for Mall for Africa?
Oops.
Never mind Nigeria. What about California?
it would be substantially significant. I couldn't even quantify that. It would be huge. Yeah, I mean, if you improve things like power, roads, transportation, and how people get items across the board, the whole e-commerce and even just movement of goods within country, and you know, people willing to move goods from overseas into Nigeria, I think would be significant. So it will definitely be very positive for a company like mine, but. I mean, to talk about, I guess, broadband and the significance of broadband in Africa, I do think some people may be underestimating that leapfrog theory, because even Nigeria, about four years ago, was on 3G, before the U.S. was on 3G. I mean, and they moved to LTE way before the U.S. did. So you're talking about, you know, a continent that's really trying to be way up front and just trying to be the best of the best.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing a panel speaking about technology and business in Africa. They include Jake Bright, Whitehead Fellow for the Foreign Policy Association, Chris Forlion, founder and CEO of Mall for Africa, and Aubrey Ruby, visiting fellow with the Atlantic Council. This conversation is moderated by Quentin Hardy, deputy technology editor for the New York Times. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch the video of this and other programs, to register for upcoming events, or to become a World Affairs Council member. And now back to our conversation.
You mentioned the absence or the lowering importance of extractive industries, but I would argue it's still playing a very large role, particularly with the involvement of China in Africa. And I want to use that as a way of asking about the kind of investment, who's going in now, because it has been very much a story of China rising, that they have demand for raw materials and have also been very involved in building out the infrastructure to the extent there is that work there. And then Mideast investors are also coming in. Do you think that kind of development is going to change things? Will that follow a different path as a result?
Well, I think I'm excited to get that question, because I knew we would when we wrote this book. In fact, we are going to probably face some criticism because we don't even have a chapter on China and Africa, and everyone's going to be like, how come there's no China and Africa chapter?
Annotation.
Because in Washington, where I live, it is a cottage industry. People love talking about China and Africa because it's like such a big thing to focus on, and it distracts us from other things. And, you know, this is the view we take. African countries have a much greater choice in partners than they ever had. So for the longest time, their trade was dominated by former colonial powers, and that's about it. Yes, China's been engaged in Africa since the 1940s, 50s, 60s, all that time. But really, the commercial engagement increased at a rapid rate recently. And so, but it's not just China. I mean, in 2013, Malaysia was the largest investor in Africa. I mean, it depends on the projects. And so you're seeing the Indians, the Turks. The Turks have made billion-dollar investments in Ethiopia. You have Middle Eastern investments, but we tend to focus on the China piece a little bit more. But the overall trend is that African countries have a choice of partners. And then when it comes down to this question of China investment, I break down the word investment, because are they investing? That's the other question. What typically happens is the majority of major Chinese projects on the continent are infrastructure projects financed by China EXIM, so whereby the Chinese company gets money to build the infrastructure. The infrastructure is left behind, and the Chinese company goes home. They don't manage it. They don't, you know, run it later on. It's a build and transfer model that is basically a way to keep the Chinese construction boom going outside of China but in Africa. And is it a good thing? In my view, in general, it is, because those roads that are built, first of all, it's not a lot of people are like sitting in a room being like, me, I'm going to build those roads. No, it's not like a lot of takers to do these particular rail and road projects in particular. So once the road is built or the rail is built, what does it mean? It means that companies getting products in, whether they be local entrepreneurs or Coca-Cola's of the world, they can move their products cheaper because the transport is there. And that benefits the business environment as a whole. So those are the positives. The negatives maybe are the kind of governance. These are bilateral deals that are usually done on a government-to-government level, and they're not always the most transparent. So though that's the downside. But my view, at least, is that it's generally a net positive. There's not a lot of takers for these particular kind of construction infrastructure projects that constitute the billion-dollar Chinese investment in the region.
Okay. I'm going to try and link three questions here because I have a number of cards. And this will generally go under the rubric of please get off your cyber bandwagon. loosely, people are saying, you know, well, mobile money is a myth. I'm not sure that's true. I've seen it. But the other half of the question was, is this future for Africa going to be about digital consumption and not physical stores? And also, what is this going to do to traditional capital structures, stores, vendors, if Africa is overrun by people like you?
No, that would be nice if that happens. I do think there's a lot to be said about technology and its role in Africa, and as far as the purchase of goods and consumptions going online. I mean, you could see it, here. I mean, I'm not going to list the stores, but some stores are shutting down their brick and mortar aspects and they're moving all online, because the word is out. You know, you can get stuff pretty quickly online. Probably cheaper. It's more competitive as far as finding items for a better price. There are many tools out there that can help you price items. So, you know, the digital age has provided that divide between, you know, what do you really get from a brick and mortar store and what do you get from an online store. So, you know, there's no brick and mortar store that can provide you with the millions of products that an Amazon, for example, has. It's just, I mean, the store would be, I don't know how many stories high, and it'll take forever to find the product. But, you know, so you have sites that provide this for you. So when you're talking about a continent and a group of people who have this really amazing appetite for products, and you're able to provide them with an online marketplace where they can purchase all of these products, I think it's only improving lives, and it's providing them with more of a choice than not a choice, which is what a brick and mortar would do. So I do
think... You're edging a little bit into the old Walmart is killing the town store argument, aren't you?
It's I'm not really going
but
there.
Then again, people went to the Walmart
right
because they had choice in prices.
Yeah.
Was Walmart doing a terrible thing? It starts to get a little messy.
But Chris, the stuff Chris is selling, you can't even find that stuff. I mean, Chris is bringing stuff to market that's almost impossible to even buy in Nigeria. Yeah. So I don't think it's a comparison.
Maybe I'll comment. We have a chapter on the consuming class and the makeup of the consumer experience in Africa. And it's our view that the African consumer experience is actually maybe going to be a model for what we'll have here. Because what's happened in the U.S. is that our consumer experience is very siloed. Okay, so we have our shopping, physical shopping, our e-commerce shopping. These things are, and they're people are trying to break it down. So you go into a Macy's and they're like, use our free Wi-Fi and then get some special coupons or something to try to like link the physical shopping to the e-commerce shopping. What you're going to have in Africa is a scenario like, let's say I'm sitting in traffic in Lagos, which is something you do in Lagos, and I'm hungry, okay? I can get, there's going to be someone on the street selling me food. I can roll down the window, order something, someone's going to bring it to me right now, I pay. Got it. That's the most immediate delivery period. Meanwhile, I could be shopping on my phone. Meanwhile, I need to go and hit one of the supermarkets on the way to pick up some things for dinner. And so these kind of things are going to be surrounding you where you can consume. And they're piloting drone delivery in Africa way faster than we are here because we're going to have like...
Well, again, necessity. They don't have a UPS.
Right. And we're going to have... we're going to have to figure out, you know, if a drone falls out of the sky, who do you sue? And that's going to take us a long time to figure out. And so, like, the legality of drone delivery is going to be slowed here, whereas in these markets, you don't have those kind of slowing structures. So you have this consumer experience.
I'm not sure that's bad.
Oh, bad or good, whatever it is. I mean, that's how mobile money took off in Kenya. It way outstripped the regulatory framework that existed at that point. But you have a 360 consumer experience that's happening in Africa. And it's certainly not the case that the rise of e-commerce in places like Nigeria are putting grocery stores out of business. In fact, grocery stores are one of the fastest growing businesses in the region from South Africa all the way up. And it's really most people still buy their food from the market, the open physical market, not the supermarket, not e-commerce. So these things exist all together and there's space for all of them because demand is increasing at rapid rates.
Okay, let's turn it over a little bit to the means by which entrepreneurs might succeed. What do you think will become the means by which entrepreneurs get capital? They've been starved for capital for years. And is foreign direct investment still necessary? Or do you think Africa can trade amongst itself and rise at a reasonable clip?
Should we ask the entrepreneur?
Yeah.
He's done it.
Sure.
That's the policy wonk, too.
Maybe the second part, yeah.
Well, I do think the way entrepreneurs can really do well and even do better than we've done is if there are three things that need to take place. So you have to have policy, the policymakers. So you have to have government influence. You have to have the investor influence, and you have to have the entrepreneur influence. If those three parts work hand in hand, there's no stopping what can happen in Africa. There's it's definitely segmented, or they're in trenches right now. So you have government doing one thing, you have investors and entrepreneurs doing one thing, and then you have people or the investors doing another thing. The problem that I see, and it's unfortunate, is there's this mentality of just help yourself. So it's there's a selfish mentality with a lot of people who have money. It's all about how can I improve my own life and not improve somebody else's life. That mental shift.
Wait a minute, you're talking about Africa or everywhere?
No. I guess it's everywhere, but it's definitely very well pronounced in Africa and very visible in Africa because you have one class here and just another class right next door, and they're not helping each other. And I even you had mentioned an example of, you know, you walk out of a mansion and boom, right there's poverty right in front.
It's a very discontinuous environment.
Very, very, very. So if you change that, I do think changing that mental switch or ideology and way of thinking, if you switch that and where you have people trying to help their brothers and sisters, you know, that is an important shift towards improving not just investments and the community, but also getting ideas out there, because now you have the kid down the street who's poor but who's a brilliant kid. Now you have somebody helping him and providing him with a scholarship or something, and he can now, you know, build his ideas on all of those amazing thoughts that he has. So there's the individual or the entrepreneur or the investor helping the entrepreneur, and then governments. As far as government has to do a whole lot more investing in its people. It's not always about infrastructure and power and roads and all that. It's also about investing in your people. So you're talking about schools. You know, putting more money into schools is really important. And I think pretty much almost all governments across Africa need to do a whole lot more in that aspect.
Jake, why don't you take that foreign direct investment?
I mean, the question was if Africa doesn't need it. I mean, that's a pretty easy no. FDI is incredibly significant, and one of the things that a construct that Aubrey and I came up with for the book, and I think we really have to plant this, is we came up with this construct of the less than 3% world. When you look at Africa, and even continuing today, across many different global economic factors, it existed in the state of a less than 3% world. So take any stat you can think of. Less than 3% of global Google hits, less than 3% of foreign direct investment, less than 3% of global trade. And I think you know, that disconnect is a reason why, you know, Africa hasn't seen a lot of progress, because, you know, it's no guarantee that if you get all that stuff, you're going to suddenly surge forward. But I don't think we've seen anywhere that didn't get at least some of that stuff that really surged forward as an advanced place with progress. The other thing on investment is, I think, and we're already seeing this, and we outline it in the book, you're starting to see a pattern where with this greater connectivity, it's not going to be as exotic or difficult for average Americans to invest in Africa. Right now, one of the biggest trends of informal investment in Africa is in the diaspora. We talked about it today at the conference this morning. I mean, diaspora remittances, like money that African immigrants are sending home from Western Union or whatever, you know, they now exceed foreign aid for the entire continent. I mean, really, that's just massive when you think about it. But what you're going to see is there's going to be easier ways to invest in Africa, and some of the former informal ways are going to become more formalized. So, for example, if you wanted to buy a portfolio of African stocks 10 years ago, I don't know what you'd do. You'd need some friend that worked at some exotic brokerage, where now, you know, we profiled the Nile Fund, which is this U.S. registered mutual fund run by a really smart guy from Uganda who lives in the New York area that does this stuff. And you could go online, literally walk out of this room, go on the Nile Fund, and for $1,000 you have a tailored portfolio of African stocks mixed across countries in Kenya and banks in Nigeria. So there's one example. Even a couple years ago, you know, like treasuries, bonds, like the things that Greece is defaulting on now. Those in the international marketplace, there's like $14 billion in African bonds that were issued over the last just couple years. And PIMCO and, like, you know, bond funds that, you know, now have those in their portfolio. You can access those that didn't exist. Diaspora investment is starting to formalize. There's talk about diaspora bonds, where, you know, some of this investment would go and you can buy bonds and it goes to African entrepreneurs. And the other thing is you also have more investment firms, like Chris can't say a lot, but he's backed by a globally recognized investment firm. And we started to track some of those firms, and some of them are in New York or in Europe. And what you're going to see is when firms like Chris's do really well, and I'm sure they will, more of those firms are going to open up the gates, and some of them in this community are going to open up the gates to invest in African countries. And it's going to be more known that you can find firms to go invest in African startups. So to round it off, I mean, more FDI, but there's also going to be more ways for average citizens in the United States to invest in Africa in the future.
Okay. And one just quick comment on that, Quentin, is that that type of question, like does Africa need FDI, is what we're fighting against. Because of course it does. U.S. takes FDI. Everyone needs FDI. This, again, this special, this putting Africa in a special category where it's not treated like the rest of the world. Yes, inter-African trade is important, but so is FDI.
And one final mind-blowing point. Aubrey and I go really long in the end of the book. You're going to have FDI from Africa to the U.S. It's already started in some very micro levels, but you're not just going to have these metrics in the future that are how much FDI is going in from the U.S. to Africa. There are investors that are queuing up, and they're going to start investing and buying stuff in the U.S. And there's already been
some another version of normality.
Yeah. Right, mm-hmm. right, right, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the growing normality of Africa is the promising theme there. I think this will have to be the last question. We're going to run out of time soon. President Obama will be traveling to Africa in a couple of weeks, and he's not going to be trenching fiber or issuing bonds. He's going to be talking to heads of state and probably trying to effect some sort of changes. What are the good outcomes that could come from his trip? And you touched on this before, Chris, but again, what would be the helpful role the state could play, you know, beyond not stealing all the oil funds? What are some positive things that could happen from Obama's trip and in a more durable way?
Sure. I believe, well, first of all, when President Obama would, when he travels to Africa, I think that's going to do one thing, and that's shed a light on Africa itself. So, you know, you're going to have a lot of press and people taking a deep look at Africa, where Africa is now, and I think they'll see a much more genuine picture of Africa and have a better view on where Africa is today, because it's definitely changed. Now, the positive things that can come from the trip is also his view on, you know, the economy, cross-border trades, and, you know, getting that jump started and kick started, I guess, even a little bit better than it has to this point. Like I mentioned, education is a big thing, and I know the president and his wife are really, really strong on education. So I think, you know, shining lights on these aspects, so you have cross-border trade, education, and even resources, I think that's going to really shine some good light on Africa and, you know, make people think about Africa as a different continent than they probably do right now.
Mm-hmm. Additionally, I mean, he's going for the Global Entrepreneurship Summit. That purpose in and of itself, the fact that President Obama is going to an entrepreneurial event, a celebration of entrepreneurship, brings attention to what we see as the next Africa. It's not going to just for a state visit. It's to engage entrepreneurs and to kind of highlight the success stories. So that in and of itself is very significant. He's going to Kenya, but he's also going to Ethiopia. He'll become the first sitting U.S. president to visit Ethiopia. And I think Ethiopia, that means a lot for that country, because people forget it's 90 million people. It's also a juggernaut on the continent. And, you know, second really only to Nigeria. So that attention to Ethiopia, I think, will bring some additional American interest. And then I will say that while he's not going to Nigeria, the President Buhari is coming to Washington just a few days before President Obama leaves. So there is the Nigeria recognition there and the importance of Nigeria for the continent as a whole. But we've seen since last year the Leaders Summit that President Obama hosted, the power of the U.S. government to convene and to bring attention to opportunities is enormous. So, and even the 12 years I've been doing this kind of U.S. Facilitation of business in the region, the amount of interest at a CEO level and curiosity just because President Obama is engaged is incredible. It really does have resonance outside of Washington.
I'm glad you mentioned Ethiopia, because we do, in talking about the region, tend to focus on three major areas, and Nigeria for a huge weight of population, petroleum, an entertainment industry second only to India in terms of filmmaking, some very powerful consumer-driven areas. Kenya, for a really unique sort of technology project and its involvement with Uganda and Tanzania to sort of grow those, and South Africa as a international business center. But what about the smaller countries of Africa? How will they be affected, you know, as Africa progresses? Do you get a window on a Rwanda, Cameroon, a Central African Republic? What happens to all these smaller countries in all this, you think?
Well, there's some ripple effect, and it depends on, you know, how these countries structure themselves and put themselves in an advantage to take, you know, to take advantage of some of these cross-cutting trends. We have this, I mean, Aubrey already touched on this, we have this convergence-divergence theory, where we're not at all saying that every country in Africa is going to become a global powerhouse. You know, some countries are going to lag behind. But one thing that we definitely think, and some of these structures are already moving forward, and this is not just in socioeconomic terms, but also in terms of Africa's governance structure, both macro and at the government level, is for some of these countries that still have problems, and this is another key part of our book thesis, it's going to be less external aid agencies dealing with these problems and being seen as the sole kind of people responsible for helping the nations that are lagging behind. And it's going to be more and more African philanthropists and structures that are coming through African states and coordinated structures that are coming through the African Union. And some of that's already shaping up now. I mean, even Rwanda has its own development authority, and they do things themselves, you know, that used to be the domain of NGOs. So those countries, I think there's going to be more African involvement. To get to your question, I agree completely with Aubrey and Chris on the president's trip, highlighting some of these things that have happened in Kenya is going to be a big thing. And if you read our chapter, The Rise of Silicon Savannah, it's probably the best preview of the trip that you could have, because a lot of the things, the people we interviewed and highlight in that chapter are going to be the same people and organizations that the president's going to highlight in the trip. My personal view, and I think it's shared in our book of what I'd like to see from the trip, is, and it goes to some of our looking at Africa differently, I would like to see, both from the U.S. policy perspective, but also across the global public, a more balanced way of approaching Africa, and that means balancing the security stuff, right? Security stuff is important, and, you know, these things like Shabab are serious, and terrorism, and the commercial. And one of the things Aubrey and I say in the book is that if you try to approach Africa, and I talked about this with the students earlier, or even much of the world, with this worldview that takes security and disconnects the economic part, you're gonna have a skewed view. So I'm hoping that from the US perspective, which has lagged behind the world, I think, and maybe I'll get in trouble for saying that, from the government level of viewing Africa as a commercial aspect and viewing the investment side, just establishing this balanced perspective where the commercial and the human rights and the security stuff get some kind of equal footing is all important, all together at the same time.
Normality sounds like a great outcome.
Yeah.
A little bit of balance.
Yeah.
Well, here's to the new normal. And with that, we come to the end of what has been an excellent discussion. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking our wonderful panel, Jake Bright, Chris Filion, and Aubrey Ruby, for sharing their wisdom with us.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council, discussing economic opportunities in Africa with Jake Bright, Whitehead Fellow with the Foreign Policy Association, Chris Filion, founder and CEO of Mall for Africa, and Aubrey Ruby, visiting fellow with the Atlantic Council. This conversation was moderated by Quentin Hardy, Deputy Technology Editor for The New York Times. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org to watch the video of this or other programs, to view our podcasts, or to register for upcoming events, or to become a council member. The program is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is David Ogilvie. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.